Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a 20-year-plus health, food, and environmental journalist, reporting on Alternet and the Huffington Post and other sites, as well as my own website, healthjournalist.com. I've long covered self-care, self-help, and all that we can do to sustain personal health, and beginning about 6 years ago, I began expanding my coverage to include all of the things that affect our health, some of which we have personal consumer choice about, and some of which we do not, because policies, industries, and infrastructures in our society can either expand our health options or narrow them. So every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss the connection between your personal health and the total health environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of planet Earth. And every week on the show, we talk to different experts, authors, advocates, scientists, activists, and other people seeking to illuminate some aspect of all the different ways that we can connect the dots on health. I also frequently offer action opportunities. We aren't going to have one on today's program, although there's a lot going on in our world right now. But I'm really happy to welcome today's guest to the show. I was immediately fascinated to learn of a book written just recently published by author and advocate Miriam Zoll. It's called Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies. It's a memoir in that it's personal, but it's also really kind of traces a very broad landscape that I think will be highly informative to many people who might be considering some of these options for high-tech support for conception and birthing, and others perhaps who would never consider them but might be interested. What's going on there? I fall into that latter category myself. You know, usually on this show, we kind of discuss integrative treatments, and one of the things that, you know, more so than high-tech treatments, we don't usually cover them, but I thought that Miriam's journey and her book is just fascinating, particularly as she is also a health and women's health advocate and a yoga practitioner. So I think she has a lot to say about a topic that affects many women. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Miriam.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, I have to say, your book was really fascinating reading. There's a lot of solid reportorial narrative and information that I didn't know, but I think what really ties it together is that, you know, readers, and this was my experience, really get involved in your journey and the unknowns of your journey. This is almost like a real-life page-turner thriller, you know, that unfolds. It unfolded in your life, and I think you capture that so beautifully in the book in terms of, you know, whether as a post-age 40 hope to be mom, you know, how you proceeded down the road of high-tech conception. So, you know, let me ask you just to kind of orient our listeners a little bit to, you know, just of some of the basic factors of how you wound up taking that journey.
Well, I did delay motherhood for a number of reasons, which people can read about in the book. One of them certainly included the fact that I believed that it was safe to delay childbearing. I had grown up at a time in the United States when the fertility industry and the new reproductive technologies like in vitro fertilization, which is IVF, frozen sperm, donor eggs, et cetera, were all coming to fruition at a time when I was coming of age sexually. Mm-hmm. And the conversation about the biological clock had essentially fallen off the table in the late 90s and early 2000s, and it's still being disputed. There was an article in The Atlantic this week where a woman had written an article saying that the biological clock was based on outdated studies. So there's still this confusion about modern women's fertility peaks and declines. And I was part of that demographic who was pretty confident I could birth a baby at 40. My mother had had me when she was 39. I had a number of friends in my peer group who had birthed babies in their late 30s and early 40s. So I kind of lived my life thinking that I could do it too. After 2 years of attempting naturally, my husband and I, on the advice of some friends who were going through fertility treatments, sought out a reproductive endocrinologist, and he told us that I was old and that my chances for having a natural birth were very low, and I should probably look toward donor eggs or adoption. And when we asked about IVF, which would mean that we would be able to birth a biological child, he said our chances were low. And what he then said was, but you never know, it only takes one good egg. And one thing that I write about in my book is that the reproductive technology branch of medicine in the United States in particular, it is a medical business. And the doctors are wearing their doctor hats. Hence, my doctor said, you have pretty low chances, but the doctors are also wearing their business hats. And that's when he said to us, but you never know, it only takes one good egg. And that was his sales pitch to my husband and me. And
well, I just want to interject here. It's in my view, and I think the view of probably a lot of the hosts and listeners on Progressive Radio, you know, this is not the only facet of medicine that is a business. It's not just that this particular aspect of medicine is a business. It's, you know, medical care overall is a business, which, as you say, partakes of both, you know, the kind of role of the doctor as someone we trust and who knows the science and is there for us. But it's also a business, I think, you know, almost in many different areas of medicine. But that's not something that I guess is kind of accepted or a general opinion of the majority of people. You know, people are at different places in terms of, you know, how they think about that. So where were you and where are you now in terms of, do you think that it's just this particular aspect of medicine that has this issue, or do you think it's all of it? I mean, where did you stand when you began this journey, and where do you stand now in regard to that?
Well, where I stood when I began the journey was that medicine and doctors had saved three of my immediate family members from cancer. My sister had cancer twice in her 20s. My father had cancer three times in his 70s, and my mother had cancer once. And I watched the medicine save my family members. So I was very optimistic about what they could do. And from that perspective in my life, I had not thought of them in terms of the medical business establishment. And in fact, I had never had any severe healthcare concerns or interaction with the medical community until I began fertility treatments. And after what I experienced, you know, I can't speak for every branch of medicine. I can only speak for the branch of medicine that I had personal experience with. And I do believe that there's a very blurry line between medicine and business in the reproductive arena. And I believe that there is not enough patient education about that, and that there is a severe lack of transparency between the doctors and clinics and their patients.
So that's pretty much what you. What kinds of, you know, doctors get involved in this kind of reproductive work? I mean, is this a new specialty? You know, who does it draw on?
I think that the reproductive medical branch of medicine is fairly new. It's a 35-year-old technology in the sense that the world's first test tube baby was born in 1978 in Britain. that was Louise Brown. The field of reproductive endocrinology is not new. I mean, OBGYNs have been tracking women's fertility for centuries and trying to improve the chances of successful pregnancies. But with the evolution of in vitro fertilization, IVF, that has then led to egg freezing, which is the most recent piece of technology that is creating a frenzy among panicked women who aren't sure when and if they can have children, I think there is a growing specialty out there, and that there are more and more fertility clinics, particularly in the United States, that are popping up. There's now 500 roughly popping up in the country.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, and they're popping up because there's a demand for it, which gets into the trend for predominantly white, middle-class, educated women to be delaying childbirth. The trend across the country in general is that women are birthing babies in their late 20s. And women who don't fall into the white middle-class educated demographic are often not accessing any of these fertility treatments, even though sexually transmitted diseases are the number one cause of infertility next to age-related infertility. And many women who have sexually transmitted diseases who don't have access to medicine or to health care or to reproductive health or fertility treatments often are going to find themselves infertile, but they won't have the economic means to access something like IVF because they might not have health insurance.
That's fascinating, too. So basically, there's a certain profile, which is the women who are contributing in other ways. And this goes back to, you know, the kind of famous message at the sort of dawn of American feminism that, you know, you can have it all. You know, you can have the relationship. You can, you know, you can have the career. You can have the child. And, you know, many women feel very stretched in, you know, in trying to achieve this kind of super mom capacity. And, you know, obviously if all the right things line up, that's optimal, but it doesn't happen for everyone in any of those departments, in fact. So what you're singling out here is that, you know, the women who are making a contribution in other ways have been deferring motherhood you know, hoping that the technology, and being told really that the technology could help them bridge the, you know, and extend the childbearing years. And then, you know, then they are going on potentially, you know, a very fraught and expensive journey. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the journey? In other words, like what is, in, you know, how does IVF work? Because, you know, I think people may have a general idea without really knowing a lot about it.
Okay. Well, when people go towards fertility treatments, so they're contemplating it or they're actually embarking on it, the options for them range depending on their ages, depending on any type of medical conditions they may have. In my personal case, My inability to conceive a child was based on my age. I began trying naturally at 39 and 40. I walked into the fertility clinic when I was 42 years old, and the beginning of my experience was invasive IVF treatments. And some advocates of IVF and proponents of the existing way that IVF is discussed with women say that IVF is not so invasive, but I found it to be extremely invasive. You are sedated during egg extraction. You take an enormous amount of very potent hormones that you inject into your body with a needle. And the amount of emotional and spiritual angst for me that I experienced was beyond anything I ever expected. And my husband and I experienced 4 failed IVF cycles, including 1 miscarriage. And our 4th IVF cycle, the doctor prescribed what he called super-duper drugs that would produce a large number of eggs for me. And that month, my body, for the first time since I was 11 years old, most likely did not produce a single egg. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started scratching my head and thinking to myself, what is going on here? What are we doing? My husband and I questioned why we kept signing up for treatments that failed. And we also started questioning the science. We did become pregnant on the 3rd IVF cycle, so we were, you know, we went from a lot of trepidation to a lot of excitement and joy, but then that ended in miscarriage. And then I immediately signed up for another cycle, thinking if this 3rd cycle rendered a pregnancy, then the 4th one will too. And I write about the psychological addiction. I write about becoming a fertility junkie. And it became an obsession, and I've spoken to many people who've gone through it, and they have agreed with me. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, I've seen some psychological studies that show that the partners of the women going through treatments often try to say, enough, let's stop this, it's not working for us, we need to back off. And the women will say, no, we have to keep trying, we have to keep trying. Mm-hmm. And that's a component of the emotional state of couples going through treatments that I believe the industry makes a lot of its money off of, that emotional state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you're describing is there's both a, you know, we're kind of, you know, obviously this is high tech. We're in uncharted territory. It's uncharted physiological territory. As you mentioned, taking all these hormonal shots, it's uncharted psychological territory. Mm-hmm. As well. Let's just talk a little bit first about the biological territory, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the psychological. I mean, first off, have the impact of taking the kinds of hormonal shots that you describe on the women been studied? I mean, does anyone know what the long-term effect of any of this is? You know, what's the... I mean, is there science on that? Or, I mean, you know, how well studied are these treatments? And, you know, is there anyone there saying kind of, well, you can have X, Y, so many? You know, how do they figure that out? What is known about it?
Well, the only current long-term study going on is based at the Infertility Family Research Registry that's housed at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital. Mm-hmm. It is a volunteer registry where women like myself or egg donors or surrogates can sign up to share their health experiences, mm-hmm. and be able to share with the doctors and who are then going to be able to track them over time, and then they'll, mm-hmm. be able to collect multiple data and do cross comparisons, et cetera. And that's the Infertility Family Registry, Research Registry, that's IFRR-registry.org. It actually is funded initially by the National Institutes of Health, and it was then taken over by the American Society for Reproductive Medicine and the Society, mm-hmm. for Assisted Reproductive Technology. Mm-hmm. The problem is that only about 70 or 80 of the 500 clinics across the country are actively promoting this with their patients/consumers. So, mm-hmm. Many women aren't aware that they do have the opportunity, if they're going through treatments, that they can help track their own health and the health of babies born from the treatments by signing, mm-hmm. up for this registry. Mm-hmm. There have been, over the last 3 decades, a number of studies that have been conducted in snapshot time frames. They have, mm-hmm. not been long-term, in the sense that I don't know of any studies that are tracking the health of women over a 10, 20, or 15-year period. Mm-hmm. But there have been multiple studies. There's probably about 3,000 to 4,000 studies that will pop up on an academic search engine search that will show risks to women, particularly with regard to potential cancers from some of the hormones, mostly breast, ovarian, and endometrial cancers. Are the ones that have been registering. And there have been some long-term studies, let's call them comprehensive studies on IVF babies. Two were released last year, one from the University of Adelaide in Australia and one from UCLA Medical School. Both of those studies showed an increased associated risk, 26 to 25% associated risk of birth defects in IVF babies, and the birth defects
20% you say
25 to 26% associated risk.
Wow, that's a very significant number. Oh boy,
and that's birth defects of the eyes, heart, and urogenital tract in particular.
Oh my! That is really terrible to hear.
But, you know, I don't, and when I was talking about patient education earlier, I certainly didn't know that, and those studies actually hadn't been conducted on the IVF babies when I signed up for treatments. And and when I did sign up for treatments, I had heard about breast cancer and IVF treatments, but I kind of put blinders on and put my head down and just barreled through the treatments because I was beating myself up and feeling quite guilty for having waited as long as I did, that I had missed my opportunity to birth a biological child. And I felt that I just needed to surrender to the science, and I need to have faith in them, and I needed to trust the doctors. And when several women who I met who were going through IVF, who happened to also be scientists working at biotech companies, when they whispered to me out of the corner of their mouth and said, "I hope we don't get cancer from this," I just looked at them and said, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" But I kept doing it. That's the sad part, is I kept doing it because I really wanted to have a child, a biological child. And again, I don't think that women going through treatments, if they're receiving counseling from the clinics, which often do offer that, I don't necessarily think that they're getting objective counseling, because the clinic obviously wants people to continue with their treatments, and I'm not saying all clinics wouldn't interrupt a woman and her partner's repetitive cycling through failed treatments, but I do know women who did 10, 16, and 18 cycles, and they failed time after time after time, and they kept doing it.
How much does a cycle cost when you say 10, 12 cycles? How much does an average cycle cost?
Well, an IVF cycle costs anywhere between, I'd say, $12,000 and $15,000, if not more. There are 15 states currently in the country that will cover IVF for women in a certain age group, and some states will cover a certain number of cycles, maybe three, versus another state that might only cover two. Some states allow for IUI, which is intrauterine insemination, which is about $3,000 per insemination. So these are expensive treatments, and they are out of reach for the vast majority of people in the country who are facing some form of infertility.
Wow. But, you know, I guess, you know, but for those who are doing them, you know, it's kind of like they have the option, but it's kind of a, you know, a blessing and a curse. Because, you know, what is the, do they have any figures on, you know, of those who undertake them? In other words, for all the cycles that are undertaken by different people, how often do they work? You know, what percentage of efficacy do they have? You know, even apart from the worrisome question of what the long-term health effects may be on mother and child, but, you know, what efficacy do the treatments have? Is it like a, you know, one out of 100? Is it one out of, you know, how effective are they?
Well,
in bringing about a conception and birth of a healthy child, not, you know.
Right. Well, the data is quite sketchy, and the only information that fertility clinics are required to report are assisted reproductive technology cycles, which basically are any cycles that require the manipulation of the sperm and egg outside of the body. And that's essentially 99% of assisted reproductive technologies are IVF cycles. In 2010, according to data that was collected from the Centers for Disease Control, roughly 70% of cycles failed across all age groups. Women 35 and younger, there's roughly a 60% failure rate. Women 35 to 37, there's a 70% failure rate. And that failure rate increases so that women 40 to 44 have an 88 to 95% failure rate. And we don't have data on success or failure rates of IUI. We also don't have data that tells us how many of the failed IVF cycles were a result of no pregnancy that month or a result of miscarriage. And donor egg cycles that fail are not required to be reported. So we don't know very much about donor egg cycles either. So that's inconsistent since 1978. There has been a consistent one-quarter, one-third failure across the board with these types of interactions and protocols. And I think most people walking into an IVF clinic don't realize that they are participating in medicine that's still quite experimental. And there were some studies done in multiple countries, including Sweden, Canada, Israel, and Uruguay, that showed that most people who were polled believed that an IVF cycle worked on the first time. And, and that isn't true. In fact, many, many women go through multiple cycles that fail. And I think if there were any changes made in terms of reporting requirements, is the clinic should be required to report the number of cycles per woman per clinic. Because if I walked into the clinic I went into and saw some data that said out of the 50 women who birthed babies that particular year, out of the 50 women, 45 of them had gone through multiple cycles, some, and perhaps 20% had gone through more than 10 cycles, I may have thought twice about what I was getting myself into. But my husband and I walked into the IVF clinic thinking that we would get pregnant on the first try. And you know, perhaps we were being naive and we were in a state of emotional denial. I will not dispute that. But we also had faith in the science, and part of that is because we had been receiving cultural and media messages over the last 30 years that said science works, science makes babies. And we believed it, as do millions of women and men around the country who have gone through these treatments. There's millions of people around the world whose treatments have failed, but we only hear about the successes, and it's a big disservice to people who are going through a very serious emotional diagnosis of infertility or coming to grips with the fact that they might never be able to bear a biological child.
All right. This is absolutely fascinating. We're going to take a break now for station identification here at Progressive Radio. Listeners, we're having a conversation with Miriam Zoll, the author of the book Cracked Open, about her journey through high-tech fertility treatments and what you need to know if you are considering such a thing. And I think it's a fascinating medical story, even if you're not. So we'll be right back for the second half of the show and talking more about some of the psychological ramifications of this process with Miriam Zoll. So please stay with us for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose-Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on the show, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. On today's show, I am talking with Miriam Zoll, an advocate and author of the recent book, Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies, a memoir. If you have missed the first half of the show, you can find it in the Connect the Dots archives, and please do also like us on iTunes, pass the show along to other people whom you feel would benefit. We've been talking about the journey through high-tech medicine that Miriam and her husband went on when they decided, after many years of a successful career that she had, to try to start a family, and found out that the promise that technology could help extend biology was a bit oversold, for reasons that we're discussing with her on the show today. So, you know, one of the things that we were talking about in the first half of the show, which I think is obviously a really key feature of all of this, is that, you know, as you state, you know, there's some science and there's some business aspect, and there's a lot that was even unstudied or unknown, which is now better known, about the outcomes and risks of these technologies and procedures. But, you know, one of the things that happens that you explain, and you've very frankly stated in the first part of the show, is that there's a kind of denial that's operative, because people so much want to have a family. And so this is a vulnerable population, no matter, you know, they may be go-getters in other aspects of their lives, but when it comes to the very, you know, personal wish to have a family, people are very vulnerable and really are so motivated and intent upon this goal that they may be ignoring some of the warning signs, and B, some of the warning signs may not be, you know, offered, in fact. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the psychological background to this?
Sure. Well, for me, as I said earlier, because my mother had birthed me when she was 39, and I had been healthy my whole life, and I had seen so many movies where older women easily gave birth, and I read Barbara Kingsolver's book, Prodigal Summer, where the wildlife biologist, Deanna Wolf, who's 46 years old, mates with a younger man and miraculously births a baby at the age of 46. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, it was just everywhere. I was bombarded with this information and this image and this cultural message that it's okay to wait. And I believe that the media has played a huge role in fueling this trend to delay motherhood. And right now, there's a growing debate about whether the biological clock is a medical fact or not. And as someone who did delay and was burned as a result of delaying, I sure wish I had paid attention to the biological clock messages. There are some women who will go on after the age of 35 and they will birth healthy children, but fertility does decline as the older that we become. And from a psychological perspective, again, walking into the clinic meant that I had already defeated my ability to naturally have a child. And my husband had wanted to have children, and I was the one that kept saying, no, 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 not yet, not yet, not yet. And I felt very guilty that I had deprived him of an opportunity to become a father. And I told myself that I would do whatever the doctors said I should do to get pregnant. And I had faith that the technology would work, because I had friends of friends who had known people who birthed babies through IVF, and I had some distant relatives who had birthed twins through donor eggs. So there was enough information in my external world to tell me that it would work. Internally, I was I was feeling like it was the most unnatural thing in the world, and I kept questioning myself as to why I was moving forward with this. At the same time, the guilt and the desire was moving me forward. There was also a part of me that was saying, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And that that feeling of questioning the unnaturalness of the process became very acute when the IVF cycles failed, and my husband and I then started discussing whether or not we would turn to donor eggs. Mm-hmm. And we did turn to donor eggs eventually, and both of our donors were diagnosed as being infertile, which was, again, another moment for me where I realized that the patient is not the centerpiece of this kind of medicine. And what I have since learned is that the egg donors are not the centerpiece of medical care. In fact, the egg donors are being given even more potent hormones to generate the most number of eggs possible, which is beneficial to the recipient couple, but it's also beneficial to the clinics in the sense that they're looking at what type of drug protocols will yield the most eggs. And in some cases, young egg donors who are producing upwards of perhaps 3 to 6 dozen eggs. I heard recently, yesterday, in fact, someone told me that a young egg donor had produced 60 eggs, and her ovaries had swollen to the size of a grapefruit.
Oh, my.
In one natural cycle, a woman may have multiple follicles in her ovaries, but only one egg will drop through the fallopian tubes during a regular menstrual period. In the case of donor eggs, women are given extreme egg hormones that will stimulate egg production. As an IVF patient, I was given hormones that stimulated egg production, but my body rejected them. My fourth cycle, as I said earlier, was the heavy, potent hormones, and my body refused to produce any drugs as a result of them.
Any drugs? Your body
refused to produce any eggs. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. But it's an interesting, you know, sort of Freudian slip because, you know, in the end, with all these drugs and all these drugs, I mean, you know, then the question, you know, it so intervenes in what nature has intended. And then, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope, obviously, you know, all the way through. You know, I talk a little bit about, you raise it here in terms of the effect on, you know, the egg donors who are taking these drugs and, you know, whose bodies are forced into, you know, this very unnatural state with unknown long-term impacts. But, you know, talk a little bit about what your, what sort of, you know, on the, on sort of like, it's almost like, in the front burner were, was this, you know, tremendous drive, feelings of guilt, wanting to start a family, you know, a kind of potpourri of what was driving this. But meanwhile, and it's very clear in your book as well, in the background, there was also this, you know, ethical concerns, what am I doing, increasing revulsion and questions about the unnaturalness of the the whole project. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ethical concerns? And particularly, I think it was, I was fascinated by your articulation of them because you were not just, you know, kind of an average would-be mother or someone who, you know, was a fashion designer in some other field. You know, you were in the field of advocacy for women and babies and children. You were, you know, probably one of the most knowledgeable in this arena would-be mothers. Can you talk a little bit about the ethical concerns that you that you had?
Well, it's interesting because I have been a health and reproductive health and rights advocate for many years. The majority of my work has focused on pregnancy prevention and the prevention of the transmission of the HIV/AIDS virus. So I had very little background in procreative issues, and I was unaware when I was going through treatments of the extent of the risks that egg donors go through. I had heard a little bit about it, and I was concerned, as was my husband, that we were, first of all, ethically, here we are contracting another woman to take her reproductive organs and have her share her eggs with us. It was just a very strange, painful questioning our values, and when we found out about the potential health risks that the woman might put herself through, we just were looking at each other saying, what are we doing? And it's interesting because since we stopped treatments, my husband and I now realize how maimed we were from those treatments and how we suffered individually and as a couple. And even though we were extremely supportive of each other during treatments, our communication shut down. Mm-hmm. But the ethics for me around egg donation particularly is linked to the fact that I'm asking another woman to risk her health for my sake. And I happen to have the cash in my pocket to be able to hire her to do that. Mm-hmm. And that felt really bad, and it continues to feel bad the more I learn about the risks for egg donors. And even though recipient women / IVF patients have had a number of studies have been conducted on them, there have been few, if any, research conducted on egg, what is called egg vendors, mm-hmm. or egg donors. Even though they are compensated for their eggs, mm-hmm. there's still this discussion about compensation should not be allowed, or should it be allowed. And that's another one of the ethical questions that we got into during our journey. Is it okay to buy a woman's reproductive egg, or her capacities, or her labor if you're hiring a surrogate? Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily, it's an individual personal decision, but it has large societal impacts. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, there's no external monitoring and really no in-depth public discourse. The information that we get from the media about this is often one-sided and not going very deep. It's often quite shallow in terms mm-hmm. of, for example, I haven't seen any articles or news stories that delve into the depth of emotional pain that couples suffer from as a result of failed treatments. And I haven't seen any articles apart from BioEdge or Biopolitical Times that will talk about the spiritual and ethical concerns that couples might face as they go through treatments.
Yeah, that was certainly very much in my mind in reading the journey that you guys went on. And in fact, any kind of the loss of a child, a miscarriage, anything in that realm at all, is really hard on a relationship because people mourn differently. They blame themselves. They blame the other. It's so complicated. It's very evident from the book that, that you and your husband have a very strong relationship. But even so, tremendous love and just an incredible thing. But even so, it's very taxing to the relationship. So I have to confess, I was worried about you guys in reading, the kind of devastating journey that you'd been on. And also, it seems like there's a lot of room for, each partner to be persisting for the sake of the other, rather than wanting to be a naysayer, wanting to give the other. That's the nature of love, So it just... This is getting right in the middle of that precious relationship. It gets right in the middle of conception, sexuality. So, very often there are many, many ways in our culture where we kind of believe in technology all across the board, quite apart from this issue, and we kind of play God. We think we know better than nature. We think nature is there for us to use, to harvest. We don't really think about the effects. And when it's kind of happening to trees in the Amazon that could be contributing to air quality on the planet, it's really too big for some people to get their minds around and be concerned about and all of that kind of thing. But what's so fascinating to me about Cracked Open, your book, is that it really takes people right into the heart of that dilemma in a place that I think a lot of people can recognize and deeply treasure, into the heart of relationship, into the heart of conception, into the heart of family life,
Well, I wrote cracked open because I realized I was not the only person experiencing the morass of emotions and the defeat of the science. And I also wrote it because I didn't feel that I had anyone in my circle who understood what I was going through, apart from my husband. And he said to me that he didn't really understand what I was going through because he wasn't poking himself full of needles and hormones or having a miscarriage. So what has happened since I stopped treatments and I have been more open about my own journey is that I have heard from so many other women and men who went through treatments, and there's a universal, there's many universal patterns in, of experiences that go on. In my book, I write about my generation, those of us who came of age with the in vitro technology and the delaying of motherhood, who did sign up for treatments, that that is a journey that generationally binds us together. In the same way that Woodstock or Burning Man would bind other generations together. And I refer to myself as a white middle-class guinea pig, and I've met other women who have said that to me as well. They feel like they were sold a story about the incredible wonders of the science. They said that had they known that it was not safe to delay, they wouldn't have delayed. You know, it was a question of myself and these other women being part of that first round of women's movement daughters who were going into the workplace. And they were we did want families, but we did want the career. The previous generation had been many women who went into the workplace when they were the first women in a formerly male-dominated profession, and they had to fight so hard, and then the next generation of women came, and I'm one of the founding producers of the Take Our Daughters to Work program, and I was thrilled to be helping young girls figure out what they might want to do for work, and it didn't even dawn on me that perhaps we needed to be also talking about we need to bring daughters to the workplace, and we need to mobilize young women and men to change workplace policies so that they are more family active and more family supportive, so that women don't have to make a decision between a career or a family, that they actually can have children at the time that's healthiest for them without interventions like egg freezing or IVF in order to secure the partnership at the law firm or to secure whatever paycheck they need to pay their bills. And that's the piece that, looking back on my life, I think, where are those workplace policies? Where are those pro-family values that all the politicians talk about that would enable a woman and her partner to choose to have children, and that the woman is not penalized for having the child, that she doesn't lose her traction in the workforce, that she has a right to be a mother and a right to be a worker? Those are the pieces that, as I reflect back on my life and think about the number of women I have met, you know, so many women enjoy their work and they enjoy their paychecks and they enjoy their travel and their freedom and they love their children. And they should not be forced to have to choose. They should not have to choose.
So that's basically what you're saying is let's not, you know, because this is going to be my next question to you. I was going to say, you know, basically this happened because, you know, that generation was told we can have it all. And, of course, people, you know, want to have both, as you say. And so really the reason that deferment happened was, A, the promise, but, B, as you're saying, the constraint that having the family as you're on the career track earlier at the biologically appropriate age is not facilitated by social policy and workplace policy choices. And I think that's a really, really important and, you know, a vital point there. It's not just, you know, these were a group of frivolous women who got distracted. And as, you know, the journey that you went on and the, you know, suffering you went through, which is true of many of the others who experienced this, as you point out, is that you were not neglecting motherhood. You had a strong drive to be a mother, but it just wasn't possible. It was a very harsh choice, you know, with the way things were set up at the time. Are there any initiatives that you like that, in terms of changing the workplace in the direction that you're describing, so that, you know, women now, younger women now, can, you know, kind of have children at the biologically appropriate time without being placed in a tug of war between workplace rules and, you know, the biology of the human being?
Well, I believe that the National Organization for Women and the Work Family Institute are two organizations that I know of that are pushing for more pro-family value, quote-unquote pro-family values in the workplace. But unfortunately, I've also heard about large law firms, for example, going after top female recruits by offering them egg freezing in their recruitment packages. So those law firms recognize the value of the female worker, and they also recognize that the women that they might recruit might take time off in their healthy, natural, biological time frame. They might take time off to have babies. And they're saying, come work for us, and we're going to pay for you to freeze your eggs. Now, when I first read that article, it was in a law journal, I thought to myself, first, that the women's health concerns are not being taken into account here. And they're not being taken into account because most people simply don't know that the egg freezing technology has only proven to be effective in women younger than 30. Mm-hmm. And the fertility clinics that are now offering egg freezing, which is about 50% of the 500 clinics in the country, are offering egg freezing to any woman who wants to pay for it, even if she's older than 30. So the fact that egg freezing has now come on the market as the newest and best reproductive technology that will be the quote-unquote ticket to allowing women to have it all is deeply disconcerting to me, because we don't know in particular about the health of the babies born from that technology. It's a flash freezing egg technology, and we don't know what the outcome are for those children. We do know that the success rate is most high in women younger than 30, and that there's a failure rate of upwards of 95% in women older than 40. So again, it has the same type of efficacy as IVF, in the sense that it doesn't have a very successful track record, even though it's being billed as this level the playing field technology. And it's premature, and it's overly optimistic, and it's really unfair. It's unfair to women's health, and it's unfair to women being able to actually make informed decisions about the trajectory of their life. And if a woman wants to go to college and go to graduate school and go to medical school, she should be able to do that and not sacrifice her own health and be forced to go through some type of medical treatments because she doesn't feel like she has any other option in the workplace in the United States. That, to me, is really a painful state of affairs.
I completely agree. We're coming down to the end of our show, so I just want to urge our listeners to get hold of Cracked Open, Miriam Zoll's book, which is launching very soon. It's a terrific book. You can find it on Amazon. It details all of the things we've been discussing on the program, and I would say is a must read for the new generation of younger women and their partners considering starting a family. I want to thank you so much, Miriam, for being on the show. It's just been, you're incredibly well informed and very caring in sharing this journey with others. Thank you so much for being with me on Connect the Dots.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. Please make sure to like this show on iTunes, pass it along through the Connect the Dot archives to others who may be interested, and make sure to come back next week for the next edition of Connect the Dots every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and every week we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. And, you know, there's always an action item almost for every single show. You know, reading the book, Cracked Open, is, of course, one. And another one is really looking at the workplace policies and not taking, you know, these technological poor substitutes, unstudied processes for a workplace that works for children, babies, women, families, conception, you know, and creating kind of harsh either-or choices rather than crafting a workplace environment and a social environment that really serves the human being and the human family. And I think that's really what we're talking about on today's show. And, you know, the fact that we take for granted that we don't have that and then we jump around trying for all these other fixes. And again, as Miriam mentioned earlier in the program, you know, affluent and successful families can do this, but a whole lot of other people are also having reproductive problems. And, you know, we need to think of everyone as well. So thank you for being with us on today's Connect the Dots, and come back next week at Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for the next show.